Box weekly COVID-19 update. I depend on KPTZ to hear this crucial information because it allows me to better understand how the virus is affecting our community. It also helps me gauge when I might see my distant new grandson. You'd depend on KPTZ to hear Dr. Locke too, and KPTZ depends on you to keep broadcasting. Please consider clicking on the Donate Now button at kptz.org to give us your support for our efforts. Thank you.
Lucky that we're in a community that was able to let these kids have normal rites of passage. So that's my introduction today.
that's really great news. And we're really working hard for their high school experience next year to be as close to normal as possible as you know, more and more adolescents and teens get vaccinated. So that's the key. Well, good morning. the national picture is really looking significantly improved. So COVID rates nationally are down by 38% over this last couple weeks. And now we're averaging about 30,000 new cases a day, which is still a very large number, but dramatically reduced from what it was back several months ago. And it's actually the lowest it's been in the last 11 months in the US. So we're kind of returning to where we were in the early summer of last year. That same drop in the fourth wave is starting to kick in Washington State as well. So Washington was actually considered one of the hotspot areas a couple weeks ago and was up in the top 10 states. Now we've dropped to the 15th highest rate in the country, and COVID rates are down by 47% in Washington State over the last 2 weeks. So definitely in the downward slope of the curve. And we're in this area that if we do things right, we can benefit from what's called the exponential decay phenomenon of outbreaks. So rates can drop really rapidly if we can continue to prevent transmission. The case rates are way down. Hospitalizations have only dropped modestly by 7% in the state, and increasingly dominated by people in their 30s and 40s and 50s. That's the new face of COVID in hospitals, are younger people who are becoming more severely ill with the variant strains. The UK variant is now the predominant strain in Washington State. We estimate that maybe 70% of COVID cases now are the UK variant. And that's kind of what we were expecting all along. It just, someone described it as a bully form of COVID. It displaces the other variants just because it's more transmissible. The what has not come down yet in Washington State is the death rate. We continue to see on average 12 people die each day here in Washington State. And we really want to get that number down to as close to zero as possible. Statewide, we're still seeing a fair amount of COVID activity. The statewide case rate is 210 per 100,000. And most of the I-5 corridor counties and Spokane, for that matter, are right around 200 or above 200. Pierce County is still in the 300 range. So there's still a lot of opportunity for infection. In Jefferson County, though, the rates have continued to drop. We went about a week with no cases at all. And then on Friday, actually, we did get a case report, and then another on Saturday that was locally diagnosed. So we had there were six cases the week before, only two cases last week, and so that's a total of eight. And a case rate of 25 per 100,000, which is kind of what that's the traditional measure for low activity. You know, originally that was our goal, is to try to keep case rates below 25 per 100,000. Aside from some very small counties like Garfield, we're the only ones in the state right now that are that low. Although Clallam County's dropping. Clallam's currently at 71 cases per 100,000, and Kitsap is dropping, but still above 100. They're at 145 per 100,000. Vaccination rates have slowed in the state, but we're still at about 47,000 a day, which is what our target has been. We've been trying to maintain at least 45,000 vaccinations a day. So we're keeping up with that. The rates are rising across the state. Statewide, they're now 48% of the population has received at least the first dose, and 39% are fully vaccinated. In Jefferson County, it's much higher. The comparable statistics here are 63% of the total population have received at least a first dose, 57% are fully vaccinated. That's the highest rate in the state for fully vaccinated. In terms of first doses, San Juan County has more, and significantly King County now has the second highest first dose rate in the state, which is great news, in that that's 34% of the state population lives in King County. So that's a huge block of people. And then if you look at the what we call the eligible rate, or at least it was 16 and above, actually the true eligible rate should now be 12 and above, but for statistical purposes, we're still using 16. Jefferson County's at 71% of those 16 and older have had at least a first dose, and 64% are fully vaccinated. And that's actually what the governor's metric is for statewide reopening. At the point the state achieves at least 70% of people 16 years of age and older, at that point the governor intends to remove the remaining COVID-related restrictions. It's likely that goal will be achieved by the end of June, but maybe not before that. But places like San Juan and Jefferson County, and hopefully fairly soon King County, will have achieved those numbers. We're now in the territory of dealing with vaccine hesitancy, really trying to understand how best to get that remaining 30% vaccinated. But we know that's not going to happen. As we've done polling and in various studies, it's possible that as much as 13% of the remaining population may still be amenable to vaccination. These are people who are, you know, have been called the watchful folks. They feel the vaccine was maybe rushed. They're waiting to make sure nothing bad happens to people that are vaccinated, but are likely to be persuaded over time. They just did not want to be in the first wave of people being vaccinated. And then there's another group that we estimate to maybe be 7%, who it really is still an access issue. They haven't been able to fit it into their work schedules, or they live in a remote area of the county, or they may be homebound. So that's the group we're really focusing on. And then those who are distrustful of the system, or who are what have been called COVID skeptics, they're about another 16%. And we don't think it's very likely that they're gonna get vaccinated. We'll never give up. we'll always keep working to build trust and to make the case that this is important not only for your personal welfare, but for your family and friends and for the whole community. But we knew from the beginning we were never going to get to 100%. And my goal really in Jefferson County, if we can get above 80%, that's of eligibles, that's going to be a huge achievement. And may not be attainable, but that's the goal that we're shooting for. And then on another area, just reporting on masking, that's been very confusing for people over the last couple weeks after the CDC guidance documents, although we're starting to get more and more clarity. A number of counties, Jefferson among them, do have our own version of masking mandates to try to keep people wearing masks in indoor public places. King County, at the end of last week, joined that list. So King County has a masking directive that's in place, as does Kittitas County. And the whole reason for this is to prevent unvaccinated people from congregating in indoor public places, because we know there's still enough COVID around that will drive transmission and could risk either slowing down the rate of decline of COVID or even stalling the process altogether. That's our concern. And so the counties that have masking mandates, I think one thing we have in common is our conclusion that there isn't any practical way for businesses to somehow verify vaccination status of everyone who comes into their place of business. That's just not a reasonable thing to expect them to do. And that would be the only way to safely have unmasked and masked people sharing the same indoor spaces, is if somehow we could determine who were the vaccinated ones. So our focus in all of these masking mandates is on indoor public spaces, places like retail shops and grocery stores, government buildings where there's publicly accessible areas. It's not really meant to focus on businesses or offices that have limited access. They're really allowed to play by different rules, although we've been waiting for those rules to get formalized by labor and industry. And that, in fact, happened on Friday. So we got the long-awaited directive from labor and industry, and they do indeed allow businesses can...
Recording in progress.
The labor and industry rules do allow businesses to permit unmasked, fully vaccinated employees to congregate and share indoor spaces, but they have to have a system in place to verify the immunization status. They have to keep records available for inspection. They have to be serious about making sure that the people who are getting together are in fact unvaccinated. And we have there's some lingering concerns about not only unvaccinated workers, but also people who have been vaccinated but may have a health condition that prevents that vaccine from fully protecting them. People who have had organ transplants or are on cancer chemotherapy or are taking medications that suppress their immune system. These folks not only we know have poor response to the vaccine, but they have significantly increased risk of COVID complications. And that's about 4% of the US population falls into one of those immunosuppressed groups. So it's not a rare phenomenon, and they're people that we need to protect. But for businesses without public access, That's something I'll be revisiting this week and try to adjust our local mandate so that it is really more focused and just tries to get at these indoor public spaces that I think that right now it's not yet safe for people to be there if they're unmasked. That will change over the course of the next month. Certainly by the end of June, we expect it possible. Interestingly, King County set their mandate to expire when the 16 plus age group, at least 70% of them are fully vaccinated, which is a pretty reasonable metric and something that we could consider in this county as well. So the idea of masking mandates, they're not carved into stone. They can be modified as appropriate. Because the overriding goal is just to prevent unvaccinated people from gathering indoors. We know that that's unsafe, but the fact that the things we now know are safe are just an incredible vote of confidence in the vaccine. The vaccine has far exceeded anyone's expectation of how effective it would be, not only preventing infection, but also preventing people who have so-called breakthrough infections, these low-grade cases of COVID. They appear to have very low viral loads and therefore don't spread it to other people. So the vaccines have been a huge success in an otherwise very difficult, very complicated pandemic response, and you know we think that's is setting us up for you know hopefully a summer that's been very different from anything we've experienced in the last year and a half, and much better. But we are bracing for the fall. You know, as conditions become more favorable for viral transmission, we expect to see significant transmission among those who are unvaccinated, and that's and so a lot of people who are doing that forward planning are thinking there probably is masking in our future during the respiratory virus season, but it also may be a way of preventing flu season and other kinds of respiratory infections. We now know that a lot of the things we took for granted in terms of respiratory infections are in fact preventable if we take efforts to do that. So that's kind of the main topics I had to cover. We do have some questions from KPTZ, but before that, we'd like to open it to the commissioners.
Thank you, Dr. Locke. Go ahead, Greg.
Thanks. I know you mentioned it, Dr. Locke, could you restate the metrics that you think would be that we need to hit locally before you'd feel comfortable eliminating the public spaces masking mandate? And second, you know, we've heard a lot about how successful incentives can be. I think, you know, workplace incentives are among the strongest. And I'm wondering if you think that that's an area we should focus. I'm concerned about small businesses that don't have the financial capacity to really offer those inducements, and whether if the government was going to help help incentivize this, if there's a mechanism where we can help small business incentivize it.
Yeah, well, on that second point, I know there's been a lot of discussion at the state level about incentives and, you know, whether that's appropriate use of COVID funds. So far, the incentives have been fairly modest in Washington State. You know, free drinks, things like that. But you know, I think that it's a very important goal, and there are some significant costs to businesses. That I mean, the best incentive a business could offer their workers to get vaccinated is time off to actually get the vaccine, and then, you know, especially after second dose, if you're getting a two-dose vaccine, about 50% of people feel enough side effects of the vaccine that they don't much feel like working the next day, or sometimes even 2 days after the shot. So some employers have offered that as well, some time off after the vaccine itself. But those are costly to businesses. And I don't honestly know if that, I haven't seen any public programs that have supported that. That's all been on the businesses themselves. But it would be a worthy thing to do. It's really important that we try to get as many people vaccinated. It's important to the businesses too, because having outbreaks in the businesses is very costly. Having employees that are quarantined for 10 to 14 days, can't work just because they've been exposed, irrespective of whether they're infected or not. And then people who are infected are off for extended periods, and you know, may in fact suffer this so-called long COVID syndrome. Where they're fully or partially disabled by the infection. So the stakes are really high. In terms of the appropriate metric, that's something I'm looking at. And it was interesting. I want to talk to the King County health officer, kind of how he came up with the metric. One thing I'm especially concerned about in Jefferson County is as the tourist season picks up steam, and folks from areas where there's still high prevalence who are unvaccinated coming to Jefferson County, our local metrics will not really account for that. If somehow Jefferson County was an island and no one was coming or going, I'd actually feel pretty comfortable right now. And people are really easing up on masking mandates because we have very low case rates, we have very high vaccination rates. If you could argue anywhere in Washington State to do it, it would be Jefferson County. There's a lot of movement, and there will be more and more with each passing month as people from, you know, not only all over the state, but all over the country will come to Jefferson County for its abundant recreational opportunities and cultural activities, all of these things. So that has to be considered when we're trying to suppress this. And we know this isn't going to be necessary for very much longer, you know, kind of 4 weeks maximum, maybe less. So we're near the end of it. And I know it's a significant thing to ask fully vaccinated people to continue to wear masks in indoor spaces, but it's really the only way, practical way we can think of to assure the very important goal of not having unvaccinated people indoors. And that's in some of the other counties, that's something the businesses are having to wrestle with, is whether they ask people for verification, and if they do that, what constitutes adequate verification. It's just something I don't want to put on businesses, but I think we can be flexible with businesses and places. You know, for instance, if you have a kitchen where all the workers are fully vaccinated and it's not publicly accessible, then there isn't really a significant reason for those kitchen workers, those cooks, to be vaccinated while they're cooking. So those are the kind of things we can ease up on without creating any public risk.
All right. I think that part of the rationale behind the CDC's abrupt reversal on this is also to incentivize people getting these very effective vaccines. So, you know, while I don't want to put the burden on the retail establishment's shoulders to, you know, make that determination, as you say, that could be so difficult, you know, it'd be great to think, you know, maybe if we got 80% of Jefferson County had their first vaccination, we could, you know, make it voluntary and still support businesses that wanted to do it. But I just, I see it as another incentive to get vaccinated that we could use.
Yeah, I hope it is too. Although there's some kind of discouraging polling on that, is that you know, when you actually ask people who are not vaccinated, would that be an incentive for them getting vaccinated? You know, more access to public places. A relatively small percentage will say it's an incentive. The most reliable incentive for people is money, is offering them some tangible benefit. But I think everything's on the table, and should be all good ideas should be considered, because we knew this last 15% was going to be a slog. It was going to be a battle that we sort of win, you know, one person at a time. And as much as possible, we're trying to move it into the medical care sector, because we think, though, in those kind of trusted medical advisor roles, that's where we're most likely to persuade the people who are still on the fence. But we'll see. We're just kind of feeling our way week by week, trying to find opportunities to get to the people who are not yet vaccinated.
Heidi?
I think I saw all the KPTZ questions, so I think most of my questions are going to get answered. But one thing that I've been hearing and a little curious about is vaccination cards being used as kind of like a ID or, you know, clearance to do certain things. And then some people saying, you got to get your vaccination card laminated. And other people saying, don't get your vaccination card laminated because you might have to get booster shots. And I just wonder what Dr. Locke's party line is on those issues around vaccination cards.
Yeah, they probably will be used again. And so I recommend actually getting a photocopy of it and getting that laminated if you want something that's kind of durable for your wallet. And even you can get the size reduced if you want, so it'll fit in your wallet. The CDC did not actually create a wallet-friendly card. It's interesting that the L&I rules did specify a bunch of ways you could verify your immunization status. So they, in addition to the CDC card, they had a number of other ways. There's a immunization site. It's called myir.net, where people can go and after a verification process, you can access your immunization records, not just COVID. If you've had tetanus shots or other vaccines, they're on there too. So it's a site that's been up for a while. You can take a photo with your smartphone of the card. That's acceptable. The state even allows for workers allows an attestation. So you sign a sworn statement saying that you're vaccinated. That's allowable by labor and industry. And it's kind of up to the individual businesses to select among those different methods. But right now, the CDC card is kind of the default verification. So it's best to hang on to that. If you lose it, we can get you a alternate form of verification. All vaccines are inputted into this statewide registry, and whereas it's accessible by people directly, you can also get it through healthcare offices, the health department. We have access to that database. So there's a variety of ways to get official documents. And that actually was one of the KPTZ questions.
Can I ask a quick one, Dr. Locke? I think last week you indicated that you planned to stay in line with the governor's desire to see all restrictions ended on June 30th. Is that something you're still leaning towards, or could you see keeping our local masking mandate in effect longer than that?
It's unlikely that we're going to need it longer than that for the general public. There still are going to be some settings where masking is going to remain, and those have already been identified as places like correctional facilities and homeless shelters, schools, public transport, and healthcare settings like doctor's offices and hospitals and long-term care facilities. Those are actually not covered by the governor's current directives and will likely stay. So anything we identify as a high-risk site for COVID transmission or a place where there are unusually vulnerable populations will likely continue masking there. But for most indoor publicly accessible places, I think it'll disappear. I think the reason we need it still now is there's still a lot of COVID around. So there's still a lot of exposure opportunities. And once that drops, once the incidence of the disease drops, it'll be a lot safer even for unvaccinated people to be indoors, because although they won't be protected, they won't need to be protected because there'll be much less COVID around.
Mm-hmm. And one thing, and looking over the LNI guidance that came out last week, it looks like employers retain the right to require both customers and employees to mask. Is that correct? Again, you said with the attestation of fully vaccinated, but that's an employer's right still, correct?
That absolutely so. And I would see that persisting. I'm not sure if there are businesses that would want to continue masking even when the mandates disappear. But I think that's within their prerogative to do, because, you know, people can choose not to go into the business if they don't want to follow the rules.
Okay, thank you. All right, should we go to KPTZ questions?
I just wanted to say thanks to Willie for sending the projection spreadsheet last week.
Yeah, these should be pretty quick. There was a question about breakthrough infections and what we know about Jefferson County. And we have had 5 cases in Jefferson County, all of them in people over age 60, and all producing very mild infection. You know, no one was seriously ill, no one was hospitalized, but that's kind of what we expect. And then statewide, we, as of about a week ago, we've logged 832 breakthrough infections that we know about in the state. 10% of them were sick enough to be hospitalized, 50% had some symptoms, 50% were completely asymptomatic, and of those 832, 60%, I should say, were with Pfizer vaccine, 22% Moderna, and 18% J&J. But that's not of any real statistical significance. That may be random. We think that Moderna and Pfizer vaccine are roughly equivalent in their effectiveness, and J&J vaccine, you know, a bit less so, but there's a lot less J&J vaccine being administered than the other two. There was a question about, do we have any antibody surveillance data to measure herd immunity? And the answer, we thought that a study was gonna, by the University of Washington, was gonna start several months ago. I just learned on Friday they're finally ready to go. So this week they're going to send out postcards to people that have been randomly selected. They're going to send out 7,000 postcards and then follow them up with invitation letters. And then 3 weeks later, they're going to do another 6,000. And significantly, Jefferson County is one of the counties randomly chosen. So in about 3 to 4 weeks, a certain number, probably in the hundreds, of these postcards will arrive to Jefferson County residents and ask if they will voluntarily consent to a blood test to see if they've have any antibodies to COVID. The University of Washington will be able to tell whether the antibodies came from vaccine or from naturally occurring infection. So they'll be doing that. And this is the first wave of a three-wave study. So they're going to do this again two more times. So we're probably a couple months away from having the data on this, but there is a statewide seroprevalence study underway, and Jefferson County will be part of it. There was a question asking with Johnson & Johnson vaccine, when to consider that you're safe from the blood clotting disorder. And the answer to that is 3 weeks. All cases that we know of have occurred within 3 weeks, usually about a week afterwards. And we still don't know for certain that this clotting disorder is actually caused by the vaccine, although it is suspicious because it's very similar to a drug-induced clotting disorder that we've known about for a long time. So it is possible when your immune system is activated in a certain way that it can temporarily increase your risk of developing blood clots. There was a question asking about Johnson & Johnson vaccine protection against variants. And actually, since the Johnson & Johnson vaccine one of its clinical trials was in South Africa, it's the only vaccine we really have some real clinical studies on. And its performance against the South African and the Brazilian variants was really pretty good, you know, in the 80% range of protection against severe disease. So what's emerging with the variants in the vaccine is the variants are not as sensitive to the vaccine-induced antibodies as the original form of the COVID, because the vaccines were developed based on the original strain of COVID. But if you have high antibody levels, that you're protected against the variants as well. And this is one of the emerging arguments for booster doses, especially for high-risk individuals like healthcare workers. So it's now likely that at least healthcare workers are going to be offered booster shots 9 to 12 months after their first dose. And that could be as starting as early as August or September, because we started vaccinating healthcare workers back in December. And then there was a final question about school districts and what we do when students are exposed in classes, and you know why we don't do what some districts in other states do, where they test after 3 days, and then if it's negative, let the students return to school. And it's without getting real technical, there are basically three ways you can handle a quarantine after you've been exposed to COVID. And one of them does involve only 7 days of quarantine. However, it allows still a 5% risk of transmission, of guessing wrong and having the person then develop the COVID after 7 days. And we don't think that's good enough for schools. But we do think a 10-day quarantine, if you're tested at 5 to 7 days after exposure and you test negative, 10 days is adequate. And so we're offering that to schools. And then 14 days is the standard quarantine if you don't get tested. And that's the one that's most protective of all. But 10 days with testing is very close to 14 days without testing. It has a what's called a residual transmission risk of about 0.2%, which is really pretty low. So that's it for the KPDZ questions. And I see Willie's got one there. Turn it over to him.
Welcome, Willie.
Hey, thank you. So just real quick, an update on our vaccine operations. Again, with the 12 to 15 year olds becoming eligible, that was a focus last week. Jefferson Healthcare did their final first dose clinic for 12 to 15 year olds. I don't have the exact number on that, but I had heard they had gotten somewhere around 200. That was wildly popular. I know they had gotten some adults in there as well, so we really appreciate them. Stretching just a little bit further to add that option and get, you know, really a good amount of folks vaccinated through that final first dose clinic. Of course, they'll be continuing on their second dose clinics throughout the next month or so. On Friday, we were in Chimicum in the morning and then went down to Quilcene in the afternoon. I'm in partnership with Tri-Area Pharmacy to offer Pfizer to 12 to 15 year old students there. We were able to get 45 between the two schools, so 23 in Chimicum, then 22 in Quilcene. And then we were, our teams were right back at it again on Saturday at the Chimicum School District Multipurpose Room. We did about 140 second doses there at that clinic in the morning. And then we had, I believe the final tally was, let me grab it real quick, 54 single dose Johnson & Johnson in the afternoon. Some of those were appointments and then some of those were just walk-ins. So we had folks who, we actually had gotten a lot of feedback that they saw the sign reader board that was out front saying there was walk-in doses available. They were driving by and saw the sign and said, you know what, mine as well. And so they jumped on the opportunity, walked in, got their single dose Johnson & Johnson, and then now they're vaccinated. So again, a huge thank you to the teams and the folks that finally decided to take the plunge almost on a whim there. This Saturday, we're going to be back in Brennan for a second dose series, and that'll be in the morning from, I believe we're 9 to noon or so. We'll be offering concurrently with those scheduled second doses. Walk-ins are available with Johnson & Johnson as well. So folks can walk into the Brennan School school gym, can get there, again, their single dose Johnson & Johnson and be done with it. We are looking for a little bit of help getting the word out. So again, if you have a friend or a family member who lives in South County who might be interested, please reach out and suggest they go and take this opportunity. This is potentially the last time we're going to be in Brennan with such a pop-up. So we really want folks to jump at the chance. If there happens to be a county commissioner with us with contacts in South County, we'd appreciate you pushing that clinic on Saturday as well. So thank you for that. And again, we want folks to come. If you have questions or concerns, please just come out. We're happy to talk and work with you a little bit and really want to encourage you to, again, take this opportunity. That being said, that's this Saturday. A week from Saturday, so June 5th, we'll be at the Port Townsend Farmers Market. Doing the same thing. We'll be there from 9 to noon offering single dose Johnson & Johnson, and we're encouraging folks to come out, ask questions. We'll do our best to answer them. And, you know, even if you're still kind of on the fence, just come out, talk to us. We can hopefully walk you through some of your concerns. And then again, a single dose vaccine will be available for you right then and there. So it'll be 9 to noon at the Port Townsend Farmers Market. Other than that, our KPTZ question this week had to do with vaccinations for homebound individuals. We were partnering with the Olympic Area Agency on Aging to, as well as with Jefferson Healthcare to do some outreach to homebound folks, collect a list, and then we're partnering with the Department of Health to help, again, vaccinate folks right there in their home with mobile teams. We've since whittled down our list of homebound folks to 0, thankfully. So we were able to get a lot of folks knocked out using that DOH mobile service. But if there are folks still out there who are homebound, they can't travel to get the vaccine, they can call into our call center, 344-9791, to get your name added to the list. When you call in, it doesn't mean we're going to be out there that afternoon or the next day. We have to wait until we have enough people to actually use a whole vial. So at least 5 folks, and we want to try to make sure they're in roughly the same area. So call, get your name added to the list, and then we'll be back in touch to schedule an appointment again once we have enough folks and can again utilize a whole vial and make it easier for any mobile team. That being said, I will plug that call center one more time, 344-9791. You have friends or family members who are looking for an appointment. They're a little bit confused still how to navigate the process. They have a question. Do call in. If our volunteers can't help you right away, We'll pass you along to someone who can, or we'll do our best to connect you to a resource. That call center is also helping people find rides to clinics as well. So if you aren't homebound but don't have transportation at the ready, again, call our call center. We'll work with you to find the clinic for you, help you get transportation. And you know, we really want to, again, break down barriers and help folks as much as humanly possible to get out, get the vaccine, and get yourself protected. That's it for me, barring any questions from the commissioners.
Not a question really, but just a comment, and I'd be happy to help promote the Brennan event this weekend. And just a couple, I guess, questions on that. Talk to the school district. You can do it without an appointment if you just show up.
Yep, that's correct. Appointments are encouraged, but not necessary. We're happy to take walk-ins.
Right. So the reader board at the school, have you talked to Trish Bethard, the superintendent?
Yep, we're going to be getting signage up this week. Absolutely.
Okay. And then I'd be happy if you have some paper. It was pretty effective during the census to put a little slip in every food bank basket and box on Wednesday. So if I'd be happy to, I have time Wednesday to run those down. If you have something paper that can be put in those,
yep.
And then a couple Facebook pages, I'll shoot you offline and make sure that you're hip to those as well.
Excellent. Yeah, we'll get some paperwork to you tomorrow to prepare for Wednesday, and then we'll be in touch on the rest.
Great. And my daughter got jabbed at school on Friday. It was great.
Good. All right. Anything else for Willie or Dr. Locke? Okay. Thank you both for joining us. So we'll be off next week. And so we'll see you in 2 weeks. And have a good birthday, Dr. Locke.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting. A recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. Thank you for listening and for supporting your local community radio station. To make a donation to KPTZ, please visit kptz.org.
And this is KPTZ 91.9. right here in Port Townsend, Washington. You just heard the weekly public health updates, COVID-19, live from Jefferson County Board of Commissioners. They're meeting at the courthouse. According to today's reports, will be available later on today, streaming online at kptz.org. Thanks for listening.